and start with number 21-2032, Morris against McDonough. Mr. Carpenter.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Lewis Morris. This appeal, Your Honors, is controlled by the provisions of 38 U.S.C. 7261A3B, which is the scope of review provisions of the...
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Carpenter, yes, but I can't see you. Courtroom deputy, you're supposed to be turning the camera so that my view is of Mr. Carpenter and not just myself on the screen.
Okay.
I believe I had just pointed out that I believe that this matter is controlled by the provisions of 7261A3B, which unambiguously provides that the Veterans Court shall hold unlawful and set aside decisions of the Board of Veterans Appeals found to be contrary to constitutional right to the extent necessary to its decision when presented. Mr. Morris made an attempt to present a constitutional issue for the first time before the Veterans Court following a board decision denying revision of his previous regional office decisions, which denied him service connection for compensation for his psychosis. The Veterans Court mistakenly relied upon this court's decision in Maggé. This court's decision in Maggé does not control. Maggé did give the Veterans Court discretion on whether to consider an issue for the first time when presented to that court.
Mr. Carpenter, yes. Why isn't it a problem, perhaps even a problem of the Veterans Court's jurisdiction, that the constitutional issue you raised attacks a different earlier board decision from the one that the board was addressing in the decision that went up to the Veterans Court in the first place?
Well, because the issue, the constitutional question affects both decisions made in this case. And the earlier decision, both decisions were subject to review by the board. The board previously reviewed under one decision, and then in the decision that is on appeal, reviewed an alternative decision. Each of those decisions are in the record at Appendix 24, 25, 26, and 27. And 28.
So maybe my understanding is wrong, and tell me. I thought that the new constitutional argument you're making attacks an August 1970 decision because of an insufficiency of the September 1970 notice. And the board decision that went up to the Veterans Court was a separate CUE claim as to the supposed clear and unmistakable error of a November 1970 decision, that one concerning the pension claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if you will note at appendix page 26, the rating decision specifically indicated that its jurisdiction was the reconsideration of the original claim received in May of 1970. All of these decisions happened within, both of these decisions happened within a three-month window before the agency.
But aren't there still two distinct claims for CUE purposes, only one of which was the subject of the,
yes, Your Honor,
the board decision, and therefore how did the Veterans Court even have jurisdiction to decide a distinct CU or a distinct claim about the August 1970 decision?
It is our position, Your Honor, that the breadth of the constitutional infirmity here covers both decisions, since both decisions were related to the same ultimate denial of benefits for compensation. The notice in the first rating decision, which is at Appendix 25, simply informed the veteran that his other nervous condition, without identifying which nervous condition was being referred to, is a constitutional or developmental condition, not a disability under law. So there was no indication in that notice of a disposition of the original claim for compensation for the psychosis. In the next notice, which was the subject matter of the Q challenge, the notice in that decision, which is at Appendix 28, simply indicates that they had determined that basic eligibility for pension had been found effective May of 1970. So in point of fact, neither of these decisions ever addressed the question of service connection for schizophrenia, but more importantly, the notices gave no indication that there had been a denial of that condition. Therefore, as a constitutional matter, his original claim remained pending because there was either no adjudication of that claim for compensation, or if there was in fact implicitly or inferentially a decision denying that claim, then the decision that was made was never conveyed to Mr. Morse as a constitutional matter in order for him to exercise his appellate rights to appeal such a denial. And he has been in that circumstance now for approaching almost 70 years, or excuse me, 50 years at this point, from 1970 to the present. And we believe that he was entitled to relief from the Veterans Court under the specific scope of authority that is provided under 7261A3B, because this was a holding by the board. Excuse me, Harper. That was the result of a proceeding that had a constitutional defect, and that he had the right under his appeal and under the jurisdiction and the scope of review of the Veterans Court to have that challenge addressed by the Veterans Court, and the Veterans Court did not afford him that opportunity. That decision was inconsistent with this court's decision in In Re Bailey. This court was confronted with the same situation in Bailey, in which this court was presented for the first time on appeal a question of constitutional implication, a denial of due process. In that case, this court found that it did indeed have jurisdiction and an obligation to consider that question for the first instance. This particular statute has not been interpreted by either court. 7292 was interpreted by this court in Bailey, but no reference was made, nor was it necessary to have been made, to 7261A3B. Therefore, this is a question of first impression for this court as to what the obligation is of the Veterans Court when presented for the first time with a constitutional question. We believe,
and Mr. Carpenter, it's your position that we should say that the Veterans Court is obligated to address any constitutional claim that is raised for the first time, regardless of what happened at the board level.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what about legal questions that are not constitutional questions? Does your interpretation of 7261 extend to non-constitutional legal questions that were not raised at the board level?
Well, Your Honor, mine certainly would, but it's really not necessary for this court to address that question in this case, because this case was only about the presentation of a constitutional question question of law.
How, if at all, could we write an opinion that agrees with your position on constitutional questions that didn't have the necessary implication that all legal questions could be raised for the first time at the Veterans Court level?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that it would have that implication. I'm simply suggesting that there is no need for this court to directly address that. I would be more than happy to have this court address that question, but in all candor, I do not believe that it's necessary. However, having said that, We also rely upon the Supreme Court's recent decision in Carr, which we believe does address that issue, but again, in the Constitution of raising a constitutional question on appeal from an administrative agency, the sister agency of the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Social Security Administration.
But also, the court went out of its way to define what it was deciding and to confine its holding to non-statutory exhaustion.
That's correct. You're right. In the Carr case, that is correct.
Carr case, all against Carr, yes.
And to that extent, I suppose we have to presume that the follow-up to the statutory questions would be left for another day. But the fact of the matter is that I believe that the same kind of implication arises from that, that if there is a reason for the court to take consideration of the constitutional question, then by implication there should be a right to present it in the first instance on a statutory basis. But that's not before this court. What is before this court is whether or not the Veterans Court erred in denying him the right to have his appeal considered in the first instance. I'll reserve the balance of my time unless there's any further questions from the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you very much, Josh.
Mr. Wisser, is that got it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Please begin whenever you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. There is no dispute here that Mr. Morris's claim of constitutional infirmity for his notice was newly raised to the Veterans Court. And there's no dispute that the Veterans Court exercised its discretion not to hear that claim, and that the exercise of its discretion is something that is not reviewable in this court under the Dickens precedent that we cited in our brief. The only viable argument that Mr. Morris makes here is that somehow the Veterans Court was compelled to decide a constitutional issue that may have been presented to it in the first instance, not presented below to the board.
Counsel, this is Judge Moore. You indicate that you believe the exercise of the discretion is not reviewable by this court?
Your Honor, we're taking that from the Dickens case, 814 F3rd at 1361, where there's...
That's irrelevant. The Maggott case... 202 F3rd 1370, most frequently cited in this set of briefing, which is directly on point, it expressly says that it will be reviewed independently at the appellate level.
Your Honor, what Magna was deciding was whether the Veterans Court had discretion in the first instance to consider newly raised claims. There, the Veterans Court had initially held that it was precluded as a whole from deciding such issues, and this court reversed and said, no, you can always determine in the first instance whether
or not that have to do with the portion. What does that have to do with the portion I'm citing? Do you have the case handy? Turn to page 1378, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 1378 of that decision, it says, although the decision whether to invoke the doctrine is a matter of discretion upon balancing the interests at stake, the decision itself is reviewed independently at the appellate level. And then it cites back to Ledford and it says, reviewing decision to invoke exhaustion rule as a matter of law. And the next sentence is, the Supreme Court used the same independent standard in McCarthy. So why doesn't Maggott control, given that it is an earlier case, and why doesn't it stand for the proposition that not only do we have the obligation to review, but we review it independently as a matter of law, whether or not they properly exercise their discretion?
Yes, Your Honor, I understand the point, and all I can do is point to Dickens as well. Of course, we have two panel decisions.
But Dickens came after Maggott.
It did, Your Honor, but we have to reconcile, since, as Your Honor well knows, we cannot have a panel overruling a prior panel. And Dickens itself cited both to Maggott as well as to Cook, and I'm looking at 1361 there. It said, because the decision to invoke the doctrine is a discretionary one, its application is largely a matter of application of law to fact, question over which the court lacks jurisdiction. So I believe the only plausible way to reconcile these two statements, which we have to do, is to understand that what Maggott was saying was that the decision as to whether the Veterans Court even has power in the first instance to invoke issue exhaustion is a legal matter that this court has the ability to address.
There's no way to reasonably interpret the Maggott decision that way. The paragraph upon which I'm reading from begins, whether the doctrine of exhaustion should be invoked thus entails a case-by-case analysis of the competing individual and institutional interests, including whether the Veterans Court should use its authority to remand the matter as appropriate to the board. Although that decision, whether to invoke the doctrine is a matter of discretion, upon balancing the interests at stake, the decision itself is reviewed independently at the appellate level. Those two sentences back to back cannot possibly be read the way you would like me to read them. And whatever it is that the other case says, this one comes first and I have to follow it.
I understand, Your Honor. I've offered our position as to how they're reconcilable, understanding this court may have a different view. At the end of the day, it's not a dispositive issue in terms of the standard of review that this court is going to apply. And I'd like to address that point as well. As opposing counsel said, that this is an issue of first impression as to how to deal with constitutional claims that are raised for the first time at the Veterans Court. And respectfully, it's simply not. I mean, Maggott addressed that specifically at 1378-79. Its holding said specifically that Veterans Court jurisdiction over both constitutional claims and statutory claims, both of which were presented in that case, it was a due process claim specifically, just like the one here. Both of those are within the Veterans Court jurisdiction to consider if raised in the first instance on appeal, but both are within the Veterans Court's discretion to decide how to handle. And this court in the Scott decision 15 years later affirmed that understanding of Maggott as being correct. Quoted Maggott and said, yes, it said that if you have either constitutional or statutory claims, both are within the Veterans Court's jurisdiction, but the Veterans Court does have discretion to consider both on the first instance or to say that no, they have not met the exhaustion requirements and so they should not be considered. So that question is simply one that we believe has been decided and is not really before this panel.
Can you address something that I guess I view as something of a threshold question, is whether, not whether the constitutional versus other kind of issue is one over which the Veterans Court has jurisdiction, but the jurisdictional question, whether this constitutional claim, because it attacks a different earlier board decision from the one that the board decision on appeal decided, is simply outside the Veterans Court's jurisdiction in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
You advert to that, I think, in a footnote?
I believe, Your Honor, in our response brief, we presented that issue as an alternative ground.
Oh, as an entire alternative ground.
Yes, Your Honor, and I want to be careful here because we did not cross-appeal, so we're not formally advocating for reversal of the Veterans Court's decision on that ground.
It would still be a dismissal of the appeal.
It would be, Your Honor, and we do agree that if this court identifies that as an issue that deserves attention, it would be within this panel's power to address that issue and determine that the Veterans Court lacks jurisdiction, and I can briefly address why we would agree that could be an appropriate disposition of this case. There are two problems here with Mr. Morris's appeal. The first one, as Your Honor has mentioned, is that we're dealing with two different decisions.
Two different earlier board decisions.
Yes. Two different, not even board decisions, Your Honor, two different regional office decisions.
The two 1970, August and November 1970 decisions.
Yes, and I can briefly run through them just to make sure there's no misunderstanding as to what specifically the decisions were and why they're different. We have, counsel for Mr. Morris correctly explained, there was a single application in May that raised claims of service connection for a couple of different disabilities, some of which were granted, the psychological one which was denied. But there ended up being two separate decisions on that claim. So there was an August decision that was noticed in a September letter. That is one where the VA regional office said that Mr. Morris's claim for psychiatric disability did not have service connection. So it was not compensable as a service-connected disability. Then in November, they sent a second letter, which said, the regional office sent a second letter, which said that they were going to grant Mr. Morris a non-service-connected pension because he served in time of war in Vietnam. They had power under the statute to grant him a pension for this psychological disability.
Just so I'm clear, those are under two separate Title 38 sections. One is 1110 now, I think maybe 301 back in the day, and the other is like 1521 or something?
That is correct. And they have two different entire eligibility standards. The possibility of receiving a non-service-connected pension requires service in time of war. So that is a separate standard of proof, separate facts that have to be evaluated. Obviously here, Mr. Morris did serve during the Vietnam War, and so he was eligible for the non-service-connected pension benefit for his psychological disability. The service-connected claim obviously follows the more familiar standards where you have to prove that you had an issue that developed during service or a pre-existing issue that was exacerbated. So two different claims, two different standards. We acknowledge that all were encompassed within his initial May 1970 claim, as is common. And of course, VA has the obligation to broadly interpret any claim to raise all possible claims for benefits as they did here appropriately. But at the end of the day, what we have is two independent decisions by the regional office under two different statutory thresholds for eligibility. And I do want to make this point as well that...
And just to complete the picture so I make
yes,
sure
sir.
I have it straight, the new constitutional assertion is about a failure of notice from the August 1970 for regional office decision. The board decision on appeal to the Veterans Court was about the November 1970 regional office decision.
That is correct. And I'll walk through the basic history before the regional office and the board because I also think it's important to parse out here. Mr. Morris first raised a challenge to his psychological disability claim in 2007. So he received a claim, or I'm sorry, he received benefits on a new claim for PTSD benefits in 2005. He filed a notice of disagreement with that claim saying that actually his PTSD was simply a manifestation of his earlier psychological disability, and that original claim from 1970 had never been finally decided, therefore it remained open in the intervening 35 years. And so he wanted the initial date of his benefits to be dated from his first claim in 1970. That was the first argument he raised when he received benefits for PTSD as a service-connected disability, 2005. He presented that issue to the board in 2007, and he made an argument, just as he does here, that the notice he received in that August and September combined letter and notice was defective, not for constitutional reasons, but under VA's regulations. He cited to the regulatory requirements for the notice provisions that have to be met. The board considered that issue and rejected the claim, said, no, we believe that according to the notice requirements in place in 1970, it was satisfied. Of course, this was still under a CUE claim as well because of the intervening time, and that the standards for CUE had not been met. So he did not challenge that board decision further. He did not take that claim of defectiveness about the August and September decision up to the Veterans Court. Instead, he filed a new claim where he said that the November decision, the one that granted him a non-service-connected pension, he said that decision in actuality was the one that had implicitly denied his claim for service-connected benefits for his psychological disorder. And that one, he didn't even make a notice argument. He said it didn't address the substantive lay evidence. It just failed to meet the standards for addressing all the evidence in the record. It's a completely separate claim of error. That went to the board in 2014. That's the one that proceeded up to the Veterans Court through 2019 and is now before this court, that
now,
original claim.
As I understand or maybe misunderstand Mr. Carpenter's point, part of what he says is that the board decision about the November 70 decision made a decision about the earlier August 1970 decision, and so he can make the current constitutional claim even though they're two different decisions.
Yes, Your Honor, we would disagree with that. Certainly they referenced the August and September decision in 1970, but what the board said there was, Mr. Morris, you have raised an argument that the November decision was an implicit denial of your claim for service-connected benefits for your psychological disability. However, you well know, because you raised this claim previously, it was actually the August-September decision that was the one that addressed your service connection claim. This claim in November 1970 addressed something completely different. It was your claim for non-service connected pension. And so all the board was explaining, which Mr. Morris well knew because he had raised this claim previously, was that you're addressing a decision that actually didn't address what you're talking about. Any denial of service-connected benefits for the psychological disability occurred in the August-September letter. It had nothing to do with the November letter. That was the only point the board was making there.
Doesn't the November order have some reference to like reconsideration or something? And I think Mr. Carpenter mentioned this. Is that consistent with the chronology you're giving us?
It does, Your Honor, but of course the timeline for any such reconsideration had long since passed by the time he was making his claims of clear and unmistakable error with respect to those decisions 35 years later.
But the November 1970 decision, I think, references reconsideration, does it not?
It does, but that's the decision, and we can look at the record at Appendix 28. The decision specifically says it is granting service-connected benefits for a non-pension. Well, it doesn't say non-pension. It says you are basically entitled to pension payment effective May 22, 1970. And then provides the dates of the pension effectiveness. And so as the board determined as a factual matter, which this court is bound by, that this was referring to his separate claim that was construed from his original May application. We acknowledge they all come from the May application, but as I mentioned, VA has an obligation to identify all possible claims that could be raised. This is a totally separate claim that VA identified as encompassed within the scope of his May application, one for non-service-connected pension.
Can I ask you something unrelated to this? Had Mr. Morris presented his constitutional argument to the board, could the board have done something about it? Could it have granted some relief?
Yes, Your Honor. The claim that he made was that his notice was defective. That's something that the board hears all the time and makes decisions on all the time, whether a notice properly informed the veteran of the scope of the decision. And one thing I would note...
I just want to clarify something.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's one thing to say that the Veterans Court could decide the constitutional claim if it was presented to the board and the board ruled on it. It's another thing to say that it could present that to the board even if the board had said, why are you talking to us about the August 1970 decision? This is about the November 1970 decision. In that situation, I guess my understanding of your Veterans Court jurisdictional argument is that if the board hadn't ruled on it, it still would not be within the Veterans Court's jurisdiction, not because it was constitutional, but because it was about the wrong claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. So there are different claims. There's also a different standard under CUE claims specifically. I see my time has elapsed, if I can provide a brief answer to both questions. There's also a different standard for CUE claims that go even above and beyond normal claim differences. In a CUE context, and clear precedent from this court has established this as well, each individual argument, even if we're talking about the same claim, same decision, is nonetheless a separate claim of error that has to be presented specifically. And there's no time limit, and there's no res judicata issue. These claims can be presented at any time. Mr. Morris can go back today and submit his claim of constitutional error regarding the August and September 1970 decision, and he can have that heard. There's absolutely no bar here that's going to prevent these claims from being addressed by VA. And then just to return back to Your Honor's question, the board has the authority to decide if a notice is defective, whether raised under VA statute and regulatory authorities or constitutional authority. And I would simply note that the obligations VA imposes for notice requirements is actually higher than the constitutional due process standard. So that's another reason why I think the board maybe gave somewhat short shrift to some of these arguments. At the end of the day, if the VA has met its own regulatory and statutory requirements for notice of a decision, it has far exceeded anything that would be independently required under the due process clause. There are no other questions.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carpenter.
It appears to Mr. Morris that the government has now conceded that the issue should have been considered by the Veterans Court in the first instance under Maggé, based upon the reading of Maggé, which I will say in candor was not my reading of Maggé, that that decision does cover constitutional questions. So the question here is whether or not in an independent review of the decision made by the Veterans Court, and the only decision they made was not to review on constitutional grounds, was that a correct decision? Should the Veterans Court have or have not addressed the constitutional question? And clearly, it is not simply a question of the Veterans Court has the discretion to say no, because as Chief Judge Moore pointed out in Maggé, it is a question of whether or not this court will independently review the decision not to review. And under that independent review, this court should find that the Veterans Court erred in not considering the constitutional question in the first instance. The government wants to come before this court now and argue what those constitutional parameters should or should not have been. That should have been done before the Veterans Court so that the Veterans Court could have made that decision in the first instance. And if we disagreed with the outcome of that decision, then we could have appealed that for a de novo review by this court. But now instead, we are in the limbo of whether or not this is or isn't a proper matter for consideration. It was a proper matter for consideration. To address your question, Justice Toronto, about what was within the Veterans Court's jurisdiction. The Veterans Court's jurisdiction is premised by a final decision of the board. This was a final decision of the board that did not change the outcome of the decision that was made in the first instance based upon a reconsideration of that. All of that took place within a 3-month window. That was all an adjudication of the original claim. And contrary to what the government says to you, there is no decision denying service connection for a psychosis. The original decision does not make that determination. It simply says, in the absence of any medical evidence in service relative to service connection, disability is denied. When we get to the notice of that, there is no reference to why that decision was denied, or even that it was denied. The only box that is marked with an X is in reference to the pension claim, which is then, upon reconsideration in December of 1970, determined that, in fact, he is entitled to pension. But where is the reconsideration decision on the original claim and notice that gives him a due process opportunity to appeal the denial of service connection? They're in neither. And the government stands before this court and says to this panel that there are more protections afforded by the VA's regulation than there are under the Constitution. And that is certainly a true statement. But it only became effective in 1972. There was no regulation in 1970 that afforded those additional benefits. So the quandary for this veteran is, how does he get this issue before the court? The only way he can get it is through the vehicle of Q. The government is correct. We did not appeal the first denial. We went back and in good faith made another effort to revise based upon Q, based upon the succeeding decision. But the Q decision is the only decision that implicates the jurisdiction of the Veterans Court. And once that jurisdiction was implicated, which it clearly was, The Veterans Court had an obligation to address the constitutional question. This court must so find and must reverse the board, the Veterans Court decision to deny consideration by the Veterans Court of that constitutional claim. This case should be reversed and remanded with instructions directing the Veterans Court to consider the constitutional question.
Thank you
very much, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. That case is submitted.